I was telling her all about Fire and showing her my spreadsheets, which she didn't think were as cool as I thought were, and talking about all these different entrepreneurial ideas. But she was completely on board. I mean, at this point, we were just both basically broke high school and college kids.
Hi there, I'm Mindy Jensen.
And I'm Carl Jensen.
And this is the Mindy
and Carl
on Money podcast, where we talk about life after financial independence.
Tell me again, why do we call this show Mindy on Money?
Because Mindy knows everything there is to know about money and real estate and investing and relationships and communication. And sometimes Carl joins her too. Wouldn't fit on a bumper sticker.
Wow.
On this episode of Mindy
and Carl
on Money, Carl and I talked to Cody Berman from Gold City Ventures about entrepreneurship, relationships, and talking to your partner about financial independence.
Before we get into this one, I want to say a little bit about Cody. Cody is a pretty amazing person. We've known him for years. He's 27 years old, and he is really, really killing it in life. If you listen to the podcast, you'll know how much he's making. Some people hear information like this, and they say, well, this is not replicatable. I can't do this. And they make excuses. I would encourage you when listening to this, instead of making an excuse for why I can't do this thing, figure out a way you can, because while his path might not be exactly replicatable for you, I believe everyone has a path and there is a way for everyone to do something great.
Yeah, take some inspiration from Cody, because he truly is crushing it on his Gold City Ventures. Before we get started, let's take a quick break. Today's episode is sponsored by our favorite resources, money management, household stuff, essentially all of our favorite things.
That's right. Today's episode of Mindy and Carl on Money. Oops. Where was I? Oh, you have an M there, so I'm confused. Yeah. Okay. This will be great for the blooper reel. Okay. I'm just going to read right off the thing. That's right, Carl. Today's episode of Mindy
and Carl
on Money is sponsored by our favorite resources, which can be found at mindyonmoney.com/resources.
And now let's jump into the show. Cody Berman from Gold City Ventures, welcome to the Mindy on Money podcast. I am so excited to talk to you today.
I am equally excited. It's been a long time since I got to chat with you guys, and let's do this thing.
It has been a minute and a half. So Cody, would you consider yourself financially independent?
Yes, I think I reached that mark from any traditional way of measuring it probably 2.5 years ago when I was 25.
25 years old and financially independent. Okay, that's a story that we're going to need to dive into quickly, because I know that you have told your story several times, but let's dive into it. How did you get to be financially independent?
I think first and foremost, I continued to be extremely frugal after college. So I was really lucky to discover the whole FIRE movement super early on, sophomore year of college, or maybe it was going into junior year summer. Doesn't matter. I was young. I was cheap. Not even frugal. I was cheap. I was not spending money on things I didn't need to spend money on. Kept that up post-college. Got a pretty good job straight out of college. I was side hustling during that whole time. So I was increasing my income in various ways, investing the difference. I had like an 80% savings rate. My income kept going up and up and up through mostly entrepreneurship, because I ended up quitting that corporate job after 7 months. Got kind of obsessed with digital products. That's where I made a lot of my online entrepreneurial money. Then I got into real estate for a bit, bought 11 doors in one calendar year. And by 25, I had $1.2 million net worth. I was bringing in just over $3,500 per month in net cash flow from my properties. And I considered myself financially independent at that point, because I was only spending probably $2,000 to $2,500 a month. So I was like well over the 4% rule with my nest egg and via real estate.
That's super cool, but I have one important question for you. I think many of us in the FI community, including me, who once took a bus ride for 2 hours to save money on an Uber when the Uber would have been like 20 minutes, we have lots of good stories about being cheap, or maybe bad stories, depending on your point of view. Do you have a good story about one time you were cheap and maybe you regret it now?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, I have a good story. It's a bad example of how to spend money. So I lived in Australia for 6 months with my now wife, Lauren. She was studying abroad. I lived abroad. It was right after I graduated college. I was like, I'm going to get out and explore the world. And I was like, I'm going to side hustle. I was listening to all these podcasts. I was part of the financial independence movement. I was listening to Tim Ferriss. So I decided that I was going to do Uber Eats on a bicycle. Great exercise. I get to work out. I get to explore the city, get to deliver food. But I didn't want to spend a lot of money on a bike. So I went on the Australian version of Craigslist. It's called Gumtree. And I bought a women's bike for $25. It was bright pink. And only one gear worked. So I was stuck in fourth gear. Couldn't shift. Very hilly city that I lived in. And I would just profusely sweat. My legs would be on fire. I would side hustle for maybe 3 to 4 hours at a time before my body literally gave out. And this was kind of the final straw. I had two people who gave me a one-star review on Uber Eats who said the guy who delivered my food was sweating all over it. So if I had a bike that went in first gear, if I had a bike that fit me, if I spent more than $25 on this thing and just thought of the ROI, like, hey, Cody, maybe getting the cheapest bike possible isn't the right solution here. So that's probably my best cheap story for you, Carl.
I'll bet your legs look super awesome. You were like Arnold Schwarzenegger and pumping iron.
The people whose pizza I sweated on didn't think so.
Pizza's a little salty today.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And that's the end of that story.
Exactly. Yes. No more cheap bikes for me.
So I interviewed you way back 100 years ago on the Bigger Pockets Money podcast. I want to say it was episode 26, but I don't have my calendar in front of me, so I can't remember
quite
exactly.
That's a great memory. I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a while ago. And on that show, you told us about this disc golf company that you started with your college friend who was working, I think he was in the army or something, and he had access to CAD software so he could do the design work. So that saved you design money and you did the fulfillment. And anyway, this company I thought was really fascinating because it gave you a source of income that allowed you to pursue entrepreneurial endeavors. Let's talk about that business for a little bit.
Yeah. So when I was 19, I read The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. And Tim talked about what he called muses. It was basically businesses where you weren't trading your time for money. He talked about front-loading the work, whether that was your time, your energy, your money, just front-loading the start of any business and then reaping the reward from that front-loaded work in perpetuity. So for me, I was thinking of all these different business ideas. I thought of starting a tutoring company, actually made some steps toward that. Starting a clothing company, made some steps toward that. The one that actually stuck, though, was this disc golf manufacturing company. And you remembered correctly, I had a buddy of mine, Jim, who was a mechanical engineer. So he had access to all this CAD software so he could actually design these discs in this program. I ran marketing and finance, and we went out to manufacture what's called discs for disc golf. And for those who don't know what disc golf is, basically picture ball golf, except instead of hitting a ball into a hole, you're throwing what's called a disc into metal chains or what's called a pin. So with that sport, just like golf, you have like your drivers and your mid ranges and your putters. And so we went out and started creating drivers and mid ranges and putters, and the business started to take off quite a bit. We actually had a Kickstarter campaign before we even launched anything so we could seed fund this a little bit, raised $10,000 from across the disc golf community. So we had some seed money, and then we were off to the races. There was a lot of struggles and hardships. We can talk about those or not talk about those if we think that would be helpful. But honestly, that business taught me more about entrepreneurship than I could have ever imagined, than I could have ever got from any book. Like, I learned so many lessons from the 4-Hour Workweek and all these other books that I was reading at the time. But until I started that first business and I started to learn about marketing and sales and fulfillment and product and inventory and dealing with customers and negotiations, like all of these meta skills and hard skills and soft skills that I wouldn't have got otherwise in school or reading a book, it was just the foundation for all of my entrepreneurial success to come.
Can you talk about some of the failures or your biggest learnings from that business?
I don't know if I'd ever go into physical products again, or not in the same way that we went into physical products. It wasn't a failure, but there's just so many headaches. And I don't think that people realize the logistical nightmares that come with, you know, housing inventory, and some things might be misshapen or some things might not be in a temperature controlled room. Then dealing with shipping and packaging and customers not getting their orders, customers lying about not getting their orders. There's just so much that goes on with having a physical product business. and the margins just aren't as big as some other businesses. Like now I'm kind of all about digital products because you can deliver them from your computer and they have, you know, 90%+ profit margins. But I think if I could go back in time, I probably would have started maybe a digital product business or figured out a way to have that business, the disc golf business, be less capital intensive, because we just poured every single dollar we had into that business. I think we ended up scrounging together an additional 20 grand on top of that 10 grand that we raised from Kickstarter. So it was like 30 grand all in, because we had to get these what's called molds from China with CNC machine. And then we had to do multiple rounds of product sampling. And there was just way more than I could have ever imagined that goes into this process. And with disc golf specifically, like there's different plastics. You have to, you know, mix this different plastic with this plastic, and that gives you this flight path, and that gives you this grip. And so we were just like messing around. It was a lot. I felt way over my head at so many different points. And then, I mean, just dealing with retailers and dealing with all of these different parties, like there's manufacturers and there's the testing facility and then there's customers and there's so many moving pieces. But like I said, I learned so many lessons and things I wouldn't do, like start a physical product business again.
I think there's a huge lesson in that. You think of the biggest companies in the world now, like Facebook, Microsoft, Google, even Amazon, who I don't think most people understand. Amazon makes most of its money from AWS, which is a software product. So most of the biggest companies in the world, it's all about services. It's not a physical product. And you don't have to say anything about that. I just think it's an interesting observation. It's, you can make something once and sell it a million times, or a disc, you'd have to make it a million times and find a way to get it to a customer a million times.
Cody, you've referenced digital products, and Carl just gave an example of digital products. What kind of digital products are you selling now?
Okay, I'll backtrack and talk about when I first got started. So I first got introduced to digital products. My friend Julie was selling printables on Etsy. And I'd never been on Etsy before. I'd never heard the term printables before. But basically what she was selling was games and invitations and thank you cards and all these different things that you print out on a computer. Some of them were just digital files that you could get on your computer and you didn't necessarily have to print them out. But I'm like, people are actually paying you money for those. Like, so I went on Etsy. I'd never been on Etsy before. And I checked out her shop and she had made, I think she had made like $6,000. And she said she had put like probably 120 hours into it. And so I did some mental calculations and I was like, that's $50 an hour. Like, that sounds awesome. And at that point, like I said before, I was doing side hustles like riding a bike and delivering stuff on Uber Eats and the disc golf, which was a massive headache. I was also doing like freelance writing, some podcast editing, some log editing. But most of these other things were taking up so much of my time to then make money. It was either I was trading my time for money directly, like the Uber Eats, or I was just spending an inordinate amount of time building the business with maybe not as much return as I want to see, like the disc golf. It was just such a mental headache, even though I was making pretty good money at its peak, which was like $2,000 a month. Eventually we got to systematize that business a bit, but those first like 2 years were just grueling. So come, I think it's 2019. Yeah, 2019, started getting into the digital products game, and I just kind of followed suit with my friend Julie, and I started selling invitations and themed games and party stuff. And so just to give you an example, I was creating a bunch of stuff for Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day is a huge holiday on Etsy. So I created like love coupons. I created these custom thank you cards that you could, you know, put the picture of your spouse in a little heart and say, I love you. So you could put a picture of Carl in there and write him something nice and say, I love you, and print it out. You know, pay $5, and it's a little bit nicer than just going to the store and getting like a Hallmark card. So I created all these like little custom niceties and trinkets that you could buy for significant others for Valentine's Day. And I started my shop in October. In that February, I ended up making $700 in 1 week. And I didn't have my laptop. I wasn't working that week because I was actually at SkiCon. I was skiing with a bunch of our FinCon buddies like Nick Loper and PT and all those guys. And I just remember that week. It was like the first time, like so many times I'd heard on podcasts, passive income, make money while you sleep. This is the first actual time where I'm like, I created these products back in December and January. I just made $700 this week. Like, it was the first true passive income where I wake up and I look at my phone and it's like, you made $80 already before you woke up. And that's why you can tell my face is lit up right now. That's why I just became so obsessed with digital products, because I didn't have to worry about oh, this disc has a little dent in it. This person didn't get their order. It was just, it was so much more passive. It was 95% passive versus this other business where I had to worry about shipping and inventory and customers and all that fun stuff.
And you said you started this in 2019? You've been doing this now for 5 years?
2019. 5 years, yeah, yep.
Holy cow. So what does this digital product day look like? Are you designing every day or fulfilling orders every day? Is it an automatic fulfillment?
Yes. Sorry, I should have went back and answered your original question, which was, what are you selling today? What's your process today? But I did want to rewind to the beginnings because I think that's more relatable for most people. Now, I just do the keyword research, so figuring out what products to sell, and I have a designer who sells them for me. But for the first 2 years, yeah, every day I was doing my own research. I was creating my own products based on different trends, different keywords, different holidays, like the Valentine's Day example. And fulfillment was handled by Etsy and these other platforms. So when someone buys my thing, I just basically list it and it can go, get sent out to 1,000 people with no additional work needed on my end. Unlike discs where there's, like you said, Carl, you have to worry about, is USPS going to make it there today? Like, are they going to be late? This person is international. Now I have to use DHL. Like, there's just so many logistical nightmares that can happen. Whereas delivering something digital, like a digital product on Etsy or Amazon AWS, these things just automatically happen. Like, you build the software, you build the product once, and it can be automatically delivered to an unlimited number of people, really.
Do you care to share how much money you make from digital products? And you also have a course around it too, correct?
Yes. Yes and yes. I will share both. So now, well, I guess I'll rewind to back when I first started. So I had that really gangbusters month where I made that $700 in 1 week. And that just kind of changed everything for me. I went all in. Because as you can imagine, there was no other side hustle that I was doing at the time that was netting even close to that same ROI, like dollar per hour. It was just so much higher than the other stuff, driving for Uber or even freelance writing or blogging. Like, I would spend, you know, 2 hours on a blog post and get paid $100. This, I could create a product and then not work in my shop and make $700 in a week. So I, for that first year, spent a ton of time on it. I think some of my best months were in the low thousands. And then the worst months were probably in the high hundreds for that first year. But now I've expanded to much more, or I've expanded to many more different types of digital products. Now I'm selling templates and ebooks and like mini courses and all these other things that are kind of just like templatized. Now digital products are probably bringing in, depending on the month, anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000 a month, which is obviously, yeah, which is obviously way more than it was back in 2019.
Say that again. You're bringing in $20,000 to $30,000 a month selling digital products online.
Yes. Yeah. It's been a wild journey.
Okay. So I know you, and I know that you're not full of poo, but I also know that there are people listening right now who'll be like, Cody's a big fat liar. How do you go? I just don't even understand this.
He's actually a pretty fit liar, if that was the case.
So with digital products, I mean, where I really shine was we did build a brand out of this. So now, since we have a whole community of sellers, if we launch templates, we have thousands of people who want to then buy those templates from our shop. So for example, let's say you wanted to create some type of product, Mindy, we could have a template already basically done for you that you could just buy from us for $20. And it's like, you know, a 20-page template that would take you hours and hours and hours to create. You can buy from us for $20, tweak it, and then resell as your own. So that's a pretty decent size. That's a pretty decent portion of our income nowadays with myself personally and with Gold City Ventures. And yeah, it's basically just been adding to the product suite over time. So like I said, once you create the product, it can sell an unlimited number of times. I have stuff that I created in 2019 that still sells today. It's not like it expires. It's not like it, you know, goes bad. It's not like it's just sitting in some warehouse somewhere waiting to be sold. It's just sitting online. If someone buys it, great. If someone doesn't buy it, yeah. If someone buys it, great. If someone doesn't buy it, doesn't matter. It's just kind of sitting in the airwaves. As I've developed in the side hustle, I've just continued to add more and more and more digital products to the suite. And now it's become a really substantial revenue source for me.
Yeah, that's like an entire year's salary for some people. And you make it in a month. Is that a consistent monthly income?
Yeah, yeah, pretty consistent. There's obviously up months and down months. Like, end of the year is slower typically with the holidays, and there's other companies spending a lot. Like, we spend a decent amount on Facebook ads, so our sales get pushed down in December a little bit. But yeah, I mean, generally it's within that range. It doesn't teeter too much. We have pretty predictable revenue.
Wow. And how many products do you have approximately?
Let's see. In our template shop, we have probably like 150 products. And then, like I said, we also have some of the products that do really well are some of our like bigger bundles. Like, we have like a 3-in-1 template bundle that's like $33. We have a seasonal product ebook that's, I think it's $27. So we have some of these like higher priced. This might not sound higher priced, but in the digital product space, like, it's not far-fetched to have a $5 product. But some of these more higher priced products that we're selling to our audience, those seem to do really well. So yeah, probably like 150 products total if I had to ballpark it.
Wow.
That's awesome.
Yeah, this is really awesome. Okay, well, I was going to talk about your wife and your love life, but I want to talk about your your money life too.
We can talk about it all, Mindy.
$20,000 a month, I'd say you're financially independent too.
I was going to say, there is some maintenance. It's not like 100% hands off. I would say the biggest or the most time consuming things with digital products is like customer issues, marketing. By customer issues, I mean, if someone has trouble downloading, like, someone has to be there to answer that email, whether that's you or a VA that you hire. Like, there are some pieces that aren't 100% passive. I like to call digital products a 95% passive income source, but it's a heck of a lot more passive than physical products, I'll tell you that. So just don't want to lead people astray thinking like you just put a product up and you make $1 million and you don't have to do anything. Like, there are some other things, other considerations, like the marketing piece. Again, I just mentioned Facebook ads, being able to drive leads to your products and pricing them appropriately and doing keyword research and all the things that go into having successful digital products are things to consider as well.
You live a pretty unconventional life. You had a real job for a short amount of time, right? You actually went to an office or a cube or whatever, correct?
7 months in the cube. Yep.
And I'm sure you love your life. I'm sure you wouldn't trade it for anything else. What separates you from someone who says, I can't do this thing, or, well, Cody's story seems too crazy and ridiculous. Normal people don't do this.
I do want to say it's probably not replicable for everyone. I just want to caveat that. I don't think everyone could do exactly what I did. I got lucky along the way, but I did a lot of strategic things to increase my surface area of luck. So I took opportunities. I networked my butt off. And so sometimes those opportunities that I pursued, those people I met, didn't have fruitful endings, but sometimes they did. So I just want to first say that I understand that not everyone might be in the position I was in. They might have a ton of student loan debt, or they might be in another country, or they might have to take care of a sick parent. I get that. So I'm definitely privileged and I got lucky. But I think where I shine and where I stand out with amongst other people who are similar to age, similar demographics, similar upbringing, is my willingness to fail. I think I've failed so many times at this point. We haven't talked about even half of my failures. I've probably started 25 different side hustles, and now I've whittled it down to like 3 or 4. So a lot of these side hustles are just sitting in the side hustle graveyard, and I learned so many lessons from them. The disc golf company was a big one, but I have just kind of slowly, very slowly, become unafraid to fail. And instead of looking at failures as like, oh my God, I'm so dumb, so stupid, why'd I do that? It's like, okay, now I'll never make that same mistake again. And I can take that lesson and implement it in the next business, in the next business. And so I only continue to get better and better and better. I don't think of failures as like, oh my God, Cody, you just failed. You should never try again. You should just give up. You're a loser. I try to think of it as, okay, you learned your lesson. That wasn't it. Now what's the next thing?
Oh, that's so good. Mindy and I have a friend who works for SpaceX, and we were talking about, I'll back up a second. SpaceX is testing a new rocket system. It's the biggest rocket ever made. And the first two times they've tried it, it failed. And we were talking about this with our friend, and our friend said, well, I think the general public sees that as a failure, but it's not, because every time we do that, we learned so much. Our expectation wasn't necessarily success. We've got all these sensors on the things, so we know exactly what went wrong. And on top of that, we get all this other information on how we can improve versus other space agencies. They want every launch to be perfect. So they want the first thing to ever take off to be perfect. People frame failure in the wrong way. And that's one of your superpowers, Cody, to see it as a learning experience and not a blow to your ego or something that's going to set you back. It might be a temporary setback, but in the end, it's going to put you further ahead than you would have been otherwise.
I think it's a societal thing, right? Because even growing up, everyone gets a trophy, that whole mentality where you don't want to fail. And if you get a bad grade in a test, like, it's shameful. It's not like, oh, you have so much you can learn. It's like, you're dumb. Like, why'd you get a bad grade in a test? So I think there's something at a societal level that's wrong and that makes people not want to fail. They don't want to share their failures. They don't even want to try something because they don't want to fail. And then they think that family and friends are going to laugh at them when in reality, most people don't care about you at all besides yourself.
That's so true. That's so true. And I see that, you know, just interviewing people on the Bigger Pockets Money podcast and listening to the Bigger Pockets Real Estate podcast, I hear people talking about their successes, and that's great. But you learn so much more from hearing somebody's failures. What did you learn from this mistake? What did you learn from this unexpected circumstance? Oh, now I just learned that too, and I didn't have to go to the school of hard knocks. Or you do have a failure. You did go to the school of hard knocks, and that is going to seep into your brain and make you remember that. I mean, I don't want to fail either, but when you remember what it felt like, it propels you forward to do better, to take this experience and apply it further. How many hours a week or a month are you spending on your printables, management, etc.?
Now, probably like 5 hours a month, just because I have so many products in my shop. It's mostly just generating product lists for my VA to create, and then she will create them and list them in my shop. And Etsy has been pretty consistent and pretty steady for me, but I've definitely put it on the back burner. And we could talk about other stuff I'm doing now, but I have shifted my focus toward other ventures. We've been doing a lot of like joint ventures, helping other people launch memberships and courses, which has just been something we've been working on for like the past year and a half. So that's where a lot of my time and attention has been focused. So I am still working a lot. It's just on my Etsy shop specifically, probably like 5 hours a month.
And still generating $20,000 to $30,000 a month.
So maybe I should have specified. That's not just my Etsy shop. That is also, I was including Gold City Ventures in that as well, which has like all those different templates. Exactly. All digital products, not even just printables, digital products as well. So that's including like mini courses and templates and, you know, the 3-in-1 bundle that I mentioned. Like I was bundling all of that into one.
Okay. Okay. And yes, is that yes. bundle still the 5 hours a month?
No. I was just for my Etsy shop specifically, it's like 5 hours a month. Even Gold City Ventures, though, I've definitely been spending less and less time on because, like I said, we've kind of been expanding and stepping into this joint venture arena, helping other people launch similar things to what we launched and harnessing the power of digital products and courses and stuff like that for their brand. So yeah, it's probably like, if you're going to include the Gold City Ventures portion of that digital product, it's probably like 20 to 25 hours a month.
Okay.
Ballparking it here. Doing some mental math for you, Mindy.
No, that's good. Ballpark is fine. Okay. So, Cody, I have known you since 2018. We met at a Camp Fi in Florida. You were the pull-up champion. I'm not sure if you remember that. I'm sure you do.
That's a great intro, Mindy. That's funny.
Yeah.
I remember that because I was supposed to participate too, and I tried to evade it. And then our mutual friend Bianca saw me walking around and reeled me in. I think I did like 10, which I'm still proud of. But Cody, how many did you do?
I think I got 23 dead hangs that day.
Damn.
Not that I remember. Right.
Yeah. So, Cody Berman, pull-up champion, you are recently married. How did you meet your wife? And how long did you date before you got married? Did you discuss money before you got married? I want to know all the details. Not all the details.
Yeah. Okay. I'll leave out some. We have known each other for... Known each other now for... I'm trying to do math again. You're making me do a lot of mental math here, Mindy. Probably for 15 years. So we actually grew up in the same town. We went to the same middle school, went to the same high school. But we didn't start dating officially until I was a sophomore in college. She was in her senior year of high school. So she's 2 years younger than I was. But again, we had known each other for a couple of years at that point. Not really well, but we knew of each other. We started dating, and that was just around the time when I was getting introduced to Tim Ferriss and the financial independence stuff. Again, 19. It was like that perfect age, sophomore year, where I started all this entrepreneurial stuff. So we talked about this stuff from the very beginning. I was telling her all about FIRE and showing her my spreadsheets, which she didn't think were as cool as I thought were, and talking about all these different entrepreneurial ideas. But she was completely on board. I mean, at this point, we were just both basically broke high school and college kids. Like our expenses were so low. I was like, look, my plan at that point was I'm going to work in a corporate job for 7 years and I'm going to save up this money and I'm going to go into finance. This is what I'm going to make. If I save 80% of my income for, 7 years, we're going to be able to hit FI and I can quit my job at 29 or whatever it was. Obviously, talking to you guys today, my story went a little bit different, but she was on board the whole time. So once we graduated, we moved to Australia together. We were super frugal then. Again, maybe cheap, maybe too cheap in some regards, like with the bicycle. But yeah, we just made it work and she was on board. We never lived lavishly. We have started slowly upgrading our lifestyle over the past couple of years as my income has increased and we still keep a healthy savings rate. But for the first like 4 years, 3 years post-college, it was just grind, grind, grind. Keep expenses as low as possible, raise income as much as possible, and invest the difference. And she was on the same page every step of the way.
Does she work?
She does, yes. So right when she graduated, she got a couple jobs in public health, which is what she majored in. She has since pivoted out of public health. She actually helps us with Gold City Ventures with some of the admin work because that's become a beast in and of itself, as you guys have heard. There's a lot of stuff going on there. And then she actually started her own travel planning company last year. So she does like boutique planning for people who want to go on a honeymoon or go on some kind of exotic adventure, but they don't know the first thing about booking places or where to go or how to get the best flights and things like that. So she actually started that last year and that's what she does with most of her time. And then we also co-manage our real estate portfolio together.
Have you ever had a fight about money?
Surprisingly, no. I think because we've been on the same page for so long and we were together, sleeping in the car in Australia, or not that we were homeless, but on some of our trips in Australia, we couldn't afford a hotel. So we'd just sleep in the car. We'd eat beans and tuna for dinner. And she was there. So I feel like coming from that together has just kept us on the same page. And so, no, we've never once had a money argument, which has been great. And I think I definitely, like I said before, I'm lucky. I think I have a lot of factors going for me in that I was able to hit financial independence so early, her being one of them. If I had maybe met someone later on who had totally different money views than me, it would have been a lot harder. If I met like a super spender or someone who, they saw my income increasing and they're like, well, if you're making that much money per month, why don't we, upgrade and do all these fancy things? Whereas, no, it's just been, we spend where we value. We know exactly. We actually did this fun exercise. And for those listening, you can do this where independently of one another, we just wrote down like our top 10 things that make us happy. And then we compared the list afterward and they were like eerily similar. And I think 9 out of 10 of them didn't involve money in any way, shape or form. And so we were like, okay, we're exactly aligned with how we want to spend. Like it was about friends and family and travel and experiences. It wasn't about luxury home and driving the Lambo and going out to a fancy dinner and having a nice watch. It was none of that. So once we realized that, and I don't remember exactly where we got that exercise from, but it was immensely helpful. It helped put us on the same page and we've been on that same page ever since.
So you got that from the Playing with Fire movie, Scott asked Taylor to write out her top 10 things and she did. And then he said, so we're paying a premium to live by the beach, but going to the beach isn't on your top 10 things. Maybe we can move. So I love that you did that. I love that you've never had any fights about money. We have also never had any fights about money. And it sounds like you are in agreement with us with our episode that released on Valentine's Day, where we said that your partner is the number one most important financial decision that you will make. And choosing the right partner has been a great decision for you. I know that you're newly married, but I also know that you will be married forever to this woman because you are so aligned in your values and you're so aligned in your thoughts about these, you know, very important things. All the little trivial things don't matter.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. It's definitely one of the best financial decisions I've made as well. But I think it all comes back to having those money conversations early. I think we probably had them early, mostly out of naivety, just because we were 19 and 17. Like, we didn't really know. Like, it wasn't taboo for us not to talk about that. Like, we wanted to get rich. We wanted to retire early. We wanted all that stuff. I think it does get harder as you get older. So if you're dating in your 30s and 40s, like, having those uncomfortable money conversations might be a little bit tougher when someone has, you know, $100,000 in student loan debt. But nevertheless, like, you still need to have those conversations so you can make sure that you're on the same financial page. And people are going to be like listening to this, like, this dude's talking out of his ass. Like, what does he know about that? But I've just seen it time and time again. Like, my friends who are older, my family members who are older, those who don't talk about money up front often get in huge money fights that sometimes lead to divorce later on down the road, just because they don't realize that they're not on the same page as their significant other.
What would you say to someone who, just say this person is your age and they say, well, I really want what you have, Cody, but I'm not willing to put up with the sacrifice. I don't want to live with restraint. I'm young and YOLO and all that crap.
I think this goes back to the big two, which is housing and transportation. And most people, if you have them write down that list of the top 10 things they value, a big house and a fancy car is not on them. Usually it's things like travel and experiences and going out to eat. And you can still have that. You can still do those things and save a really massive proportion of your income. So what I did personally was, I'm still house hacking. My net worth just crossed $2.5 million last month. I'm still house hacking. Like, most people aren't willing to do that. And they don't even want to do that when their net worth is negative $50,000. I am still driving the same paid off car that I was driving before. And most people don't want to do that. So it's like, even though those things don't bring a lot of value, like you just mentioned, Taylor, Scott's wife, wanted to live close to the beach, even though the beach wasn't on our top 10 list. Give yourself a long, hard talk. Give yourself a long, hard talk, if that makes sense. But just really think about what you value. And most of the time, unless you're a car enthusiast or unless you're just obsessed with HGTV and you want the most fancy home ever, and that just brings you so much value, sure, save up, do it the right way and figure out how you can afford that. But for most people, if you can get those two under control, then you can spend pretty lavishly in some of these other areas. Like the average, let's just use a $4,000 budget. If you can reclaim $2,000 of that by house hacking and driving a paid off car instead of leasing a car and renting a, you know, a studio or a one bedroom somewhere expensive, like in Boston, which is close to me, then you just reclaimed, you know, $2,000 a month you spend with just two little choices. Like, you're not going to get $2,000 back from, you know, going out to eat one less time per week or cutting back on coffee or canceling Netflix. Like, you're just not going to get those big financial wins. You're going to get the big financial wins, the big savings wins from those big categories. So that's what I would say to someone my age, Carl, is like, even if you do want the fancy house and the fancy car, like, sacrifice for 5 years and you can have a massive savings rate if you're willing to live a little bit differently, maybe house hack, maybe rent out a room, drive a paid off car, you know, buy a 5 to 7 year old used car that you can buy in cash instead of leasing the newest 2024 version. There's just a lot of things you can do on those big expense fronts that most people are unwilling to do, or they don't realize the financial impact they could have.
If you still want that thing, just save up a little bit and then postpone it just a couple of years. Get your money right first, and then you can have your BMW or whatever fancy thing you want in your life. That's so important. I think a lot of people, if they went through that exercise after 5 or 7 years or whatever, they might realize that they don't want that thing anymore, which is pretty cool too. And what advice would you give to a young couple who might be dating or someone potentially looking for a partner that wants to make sure they're on the same page? This is a broad question. One question we get all the time is, aware of the whole FIRE thing, and that's something I want to do in my life, and I want to make sure my partner's on board, or I want to find a partner who is on board. And I think you and I, Cody, are very fortunate in that we found that.
Yes, and, you are.
Like Mindy alluded to before, it's the single most important thing in life. And if you get that right, a lot of stuff is going to take care of itself. So what advice would you give to someone who's dating or looking for a partner with similar money values?
I think if you're specifically looking for a partner with these same money values, it's going to be tough. I would say lead with your heart, like find the right person for you. Don't just pick from this specific pool of fire people on some like fire dating app. But if you are someone who's trying to convince a spouse to get on the path with you, don't go the path that I went right at the beginning, which was the spreadsheet route. Like I quickly realized that was not the route. I'm like, I'm showing her my spreadsheet in Excel. I'm like, look at this compound interest. If we save this much for 7 years, like we can hit financial independence. No, you got to lead with the destination. Like nobody's selling the, you know, the plane ticket to Aruba, talking about all of the stuff on the plane, like, oh man, the seat's so comfy and, you know, the plane has all these awesome snacks. No, you're selling the destination. Like you're talking about how awesome the beaches are at Aruba and the water's 85 degrees. So it's the same thing when you're trying to convince a spouse on this path. It's like, okay, the journey might not be super glorious. Like there might be a little bit of turbulence, but once we get there, we're going to be chilling. Like it's going to be awesome. So I think a lot of people go wrong trying to sell the journey where they should be selling the destination to a spouse. The spouse doesn't care about savings rates. They don't care about compound interest or spreadsheets. What they do care about is, hey, babe, if we do this for 10 years, we don't have to work anymore. We can do whatever we want with our days. We can go to the park in the middle of the day. We can go to the gym in the middle of the day. We can spend more time with our kids. We can do more stuff with friends. We can go on more trips. Leading with that is going to be a lot more effective than selling them the spreadsheet route.
Oh, that's so good. Start at the end and work backwards.
Yeah, Cody Berman is only 27 in actual age. He's wise beyond his years.
Thanks, Mindy. I have a lot to learn still.
Well, that's very humble, but also I think that you are wise beyond your years. I'm not just saying that. I love talking to you. And I am so thankful for your time today. Cody, where can people find you online?
If people like listening to me talk about financial independence and things of that sort, I do have a podcast of my own called The Financial Independence Show, or The FI Show for short. And then all things digital products. And my main business is called Gold City Ventures, goldcityventures.com.
We will link to all of this in the show notes. Thank you so much, Cody.
Appreciate you guys. It's a lot of fun.
You couldn't even draw that out long enough so I could blow my nose. Are you Cody Berman from Fly to Fi or Cody Berman from Goldman Sachs Printables?
The last time I heard you guys were finishing up some reno stuff, did that all get completed? Or is that still in? So that's a no.
Almost. We're so close.
Almost.
And yet so far away.
We're like 40 hours away, though. Almost.
Yeah, we just need to sit down, buckle down, and like just bust it. But it's like all the little bitsy, I think it's more than 40 hours, but it's all the little like end stuff. It's not the big remodel. It's the little bitty putting back together stuff that you're like, it doesn't make any difference once it's done, but it's noticeable when it's not done.
I saw today a study about rats and I sent it to you. Did you read it?
You didn't send it to me. You posted it on Twitter.
Okay, well,
I didn't read it. You said, let's get a rat. And I said, no.
You could have read the story. Rats are pretty smart and they enjoy play. Like it enhances their brain or whatever. They did a brain scan on rats and then they tickled the rats. Like they put electrodes. If you're watching on YouTube, Mitty's looking at me like I'm nuts. So the focus of this study was, I don't know who came up with this. They put something on the rat's brain to scan it, and then they tickle the rat. And it turns out rats actually make a laughing sound like people, and they enjoy it. They could see the dopamine going crazy or whatever it is in the brain. I thought this was pretty cool. It kind of made me want to go out and purchase a rat. What do you think?
No.
No rats or no tickling the rat?
Both. Okay. No rats. Okay. I don't want any rats in my house.
Okay. We've had a mouse in our house, and a rat is just like a supersized mouse.
I think they're two different species. I'm not a ratologist, but I do believe they're two different species. And also, we didn't have the mouse in our house on purpose. They just come in.
Yeah, it was an unwelcome guess. But are mice afraid of rats if we bought a rat?
I don't know. Why do they know all this about rats.
I don't know. I thought you were a ratologist.
I said I wasn't a ratologist. You're the one who read the article.
We escaped the rat race.
Oh, I'm so done with you.
We must know something about rats.
The rat just snorted.
If anyone has a pet rat and loves their rat, as Mindy would not, send your comments to Mindy at mindy@mindyandmoney.com. If you love rats, regale me with your rat tales. See what I did there, rat tales? At carl@mindyandmoney.com.
How do I keep finding podcast hosts who make these terrible jokes?
There's more where that came from, honey.
I know.
Okay, great.